Another rainy day, Denko A. Transmitting the light. Today's story and the transmission of light is, like all the stories, about teacher and student relationship, and particularly this one seems to be about destiny and the mysterious workings of karmic affinity in these relationships. So I've just been reflecting on my own relationships with teachers, and what is destiny? Somehow, connections happen in mysterious ways, and it's something we can never really explain, luckily. My root teacher, Tenshin Zenki, Daiyo Sho. I remember our first meeting at San Francisco Zen Center, at Beginner's Mind Temple. I was a brand new guest student waiting for Tassajara summer season to open so I could go stay there for the summer. And so I spent about a week at the city center there, and Tenshin Roshi was abbot at the time, and he was giving a class in a class series, and everyone was invited to just drop by, and I was there, so I didn't have anything else to do. So I went, and I don't remember what he was talking about. He might have been going through the koans of the Book of Serenity at that time, but the part that I do remember is something about how our practice is about an inner realization and way of being that doesn't depend on any external forms or signs or marks. And he said, as the abbot of Zen Center, he said, "So sometimes I think it might be best if we burnt down the Zen Center and we all just spilled out into the streets of San Francisco and just live our life and benefit others." That's the part I remember. And I was impressed that the abbot of the Zen Center was thinking that maybe it would be best to burn down the Zen Center. And that's the part I remember, and that's the part I remember thinking, I want to spend some more time with this guy. I would say something like that. And that's the way it worked out. I got to spend a lot more time with him. And my gratitude for all those years is hard to even speak about. So is that some kind of karmic destiny? I don't know. Then I would say that, of course, my root teacher had the most influence on my practice, and I think I could say the most influence on my entire life of any people, I think more than my parents. And maybe the second most strong influence from a Zen teacher, though I practiced with many Zen teachers at San Francisco Zen Center over those 19 years, naturally many, many Dokusans with many, many teachers, many practice periods with many teachers, and always received gifts, Dharma gifts from all of them. But somehow, due to just karmic affinity, whatever, I think the next most important teacher was Tongen Harada Roshi, my teacher in Japan, who I only saw for, I think maybe 10 months of my life. And I have this sense that I might not ever see him again. He's quite old now. You never know. But, and I went there with an open-ended ticket, not knowing how long I would stay, but I had heard things about this teacher and wanted to go meet him and practice with him. So, again, I remember our first meeting. Maybe first impressions go a long way, right? In both these cases, one was yeah, 26 years ago, and this was, I don't know, a long time ago. But the first meeting was the people just arriving at the monastery go to have Dokusan, and as is somewhat traditional, old style in Japanese Zen, my root teacher wrote a letter to the teacher I would be practicing with in Japan, saying, "This is my student Kokyo. Please take care of him and train him well." And Tongen Roshi speaks almost no English and reads no English, so we have a translator there in Dokusan. She translates the letter into Japanese, and he kind of looks at me and sizes me up. And he asks some questions, and I remember saying affirmatively, like, "Mm-hmm." And he would say, "Do not say mm-hmm. Say hi." So I was a little bit intimidated by this teacher, and then at the end of our short meeting, face to face in Dokusan, sitting in seiza, I bow down for the prostration, and the Kyosaku lands swiftly on my back. Perfect timing. Which this was not part of my experience at San Francisco Zen Center. Something new, refreshing, a bit scary. And then I proceeded to have many, many, many Dokusans with him. And he changed me. Just like all relationships change us. And I remember our parting too, our last Dokusan. Even thinking at that time, this person has been so important to me, but I may never see him again. He quoted the end of the jewel mirror samadhi, saying, "Just to continue in this way is called the host within the host." And as his final words I heard from him. And then I have many strong connections with Dharma teachers in the Tibetan tradition as well in more recent times. One of them that really has a flavor of some sort of mysterious destiny is when I first went over to Nepal in 1990 or 91, a long time ago, I heard about this one teacher, Choki Nima Rinpoche, before I even went. And I knew that he gave these weekly talks to, in English to his Western students. So that was one of the things on my list that I wanted to do in my travels to Nepal and India, is meet him. And it so happened that after some weeks of traveling through India, ended up in Nepal, and by that point in the journey, I was quite sick, which is kind of par for the course over there. There for long enough. Like, so much that when the bus arrived in Kathmandu, I was, you know, waiting for, like, you know, counting the seconds till it would pull up and stop. And as soon as it stopped, I pushed by everybody, ran outside, and just threw up all over the place. Like, I made it. I got my dear. And then I was holed up in bed. I was traveling with this friend of mine, Roberto. And we were both planning to go see Choki Nima Rinpoche for his Saturday talk. And I really wanted to go, and you know, I could move around a little bit, but that morning it was just like, I'm so sorry, there is no way I can get out of bed today. I was, you know, tempted to try to drag myself, because I think it was maybe like the 1 week that we were there, he was giving a talk. So I missed it. One of the main items on my list tonight. And Roberto came back and said, "Oh, it's a great talk." Told me about. And I remember thinking at the time, I guess it just wasn't like, I didn't have the karmic affinity to meet him. It wasn't my destiny to meet him, even though I wanted to. All the conditions were not lined up for that. And I didn't meet him. And then as the years went by of Zen practice, of course, I came across his books and read some of his books and thought, oh, I'm so sorry I never met this teacher. I am moved through his written words. And then, almost 20 years later, I found myself back in Nepal with Shoho shortly after I'd come to Santa Cruz here. And this time it was maybe like at the top of my list, meeting Choki Nima Rinpoche. I'd done several retreats with his brother, Sokhenyi Rinpoche, who by that point I considered my root teacher in the Dzogchen tradition. This word root teacher is kind of nice and spans these different traditions. In Japanese we say honshi. Honshi means root teacher, and technically speaking it means the one who transmits the Dharma to you. The one whose Dharma you inherit is your root teacher. And it, the same word, I don't know how you pronounce it in Tibetan, but root teacher in the Dzogchen tradition is defined actually as the teacher who points out the true nature of mind to you in a way that you get it for the first time. So maybe, really strictly speaking, it would be like you can only have one, and because there's the one time that you first get it, not intellectually, but you really get it. And, but because things are not so strictly defined in this life, there's people, as I practice more in that tradition, I found people had many root teachers. as well as many other teachers. And I think that that maybe just meant like, or you have a really strong connection with them and their dharma and their way of being. So, so Shoho and I are in Nepal, and it's the Saturday talk. After almost 20 years, he's still giving the Saturday talk almost every week, Chokinima Rinpoche, or when he's around. And so we're there in town, and it's Saturday, but we don't know what time the talk is. Somehow we couldn't figure it out. And so at some point in the morning, let's go pretty early and make sure that we don't miss it. We walk over to his huge monastery, and there's this flow of hundreds of people coming out the door. Oh no. We missed it again. Rinpoche's gone. We ask people, is he around? Can we just meet with him briefly? Nope, he just hopped right in a car and drove off to some other Dharma event. And how about next Saturday? We'll be here next Saturday. There's a talk, right? Nope, he's traveling around the world. He won't be back for a couple months. Oh no. Well, he's not even going to be back in town here in the next month? Nope, just left for the airport. Oh no, I don't know, he wasn't around. He might have even said that he left for the airport. It was a great letdown. And again, Shoho and I looked at each other and thought, I guess we just don't have the destiny to meet this teacher. This happened again. Oh well, we got to meet some other teachers. And then a few days later, we went outside of Kathmandu up to Parping, the rural hill border of the valley of Kathmandu, up into the mountains a little bit there, where the air is clean and fresh, and it's like one of the great sacred holy sites of the Kathmandu Valley is Parping. And particularly, maybe the whole village even grew up around this cave where the great Padmasambhava had practiced and had great realization in this cave, around which a monastery was built. A monastery actually under the guidance of Chokinima Rinpoche. It was kind of his sort of mountain retreat place, one of them. So we're up there paying our respects to this sacred site, and sitting in this cave is a wonderful practice one can do. And we were there for a few days, and we're hanging around the cave, just, you know, 10 feet from the cave. There's this kind of corner of a building there, and we're standing there, and around the corner from right out of the cave, comes around the corner, and we're standing face to face with Chokinima Rinpoche. And it was like shock in both ways, because he almost ran into us. And because it's like, this can't be. He's supposed to be gone, and we're nowhere near his monastery anymore down in town. And everything stopped. We stopped, and he stopped. He had a kind of entourage of monks around him. And he looked at us in the eye and said, "Do I know you?" And I think I said, Chokinima Rinpoche. I mean, I'd never met him before, but I knew what he looked like because I'd seen photos. And we just came to try to see you, and we made all these efforts to try to meet you in one way or another, and we thought you were gone. And he's like, I'm here. And we got to actually like ask him some Dharma questions even. He was very patient and available, always wonderful teacher in this way. And he said, well, are you going back down to the valley? If so, you can ride down with me and my entourage. And we're like, actually, no, we're staying up here. Although we were tempted to, like, let's just say yes. We'll just leave all our stuff up here. And I mean, isn't this some sort of destiny? But we didn't ride down with him, but we had met. And then that a seed was planted. And then somehow more causes and conditions unfolded. And that's the monastery where Shoho went to go to school and practice for 3 years. And Choki Nyingma Rinpoche, she considers her root teacher, very close connection with him now. She's really kind of gone over to the other side as a Zen priest. These are all just Dharma teachers, I think, in the great ecumenical spirit of Dharma, especially the Mahayana Dharma. It's all pointing the same way as far as I can see. And it's just about karmic affinities and connections, how we end up in these different relationships, so mysterious. The sixth ancestor in India, in our lineage, was Nichaka. In our morning chant, we say, Nichaka Daiyosho. Once the fifth ancestor said to him, the Buddha said, practicing wizardry and studying the trivial is like being dragged around with a rope. The Buddha said that. So you yourself should know that if you leave the small stream, or the minor trivial stream, and immediately come to the great ocean, you will realize the unborn. Hearing this, Nichaka experienced awakening. Wizardry is this term. Sen, or a wizard, is senin in Japanese. And it means like hermit or wizard or sorcerer or shaman. So not exactly like a Buddhist term, but a spiritual term in East Asia. And the Chinese character is the radical for person next to mountain. So it's like mountain person. That's where the wizards and sorcerers live. And Keizan recalls the story of Nichaka from the old records. He was from central India and was the leader of 8,000 wizards. Now, try to picture a scene from Lord of the Rings. Out in the wilderness, there's a grand castle of 8,000 wizards, and Nichaka is their leader, who lives in the room at the peak of the tower, looking into his crystal ball. One day, while leading his followers, his wizard followers, he respectfully paid reverence to Durtaka. Dai Taka Daiyosho. He said, in former lives we were both born in the Brahma heavens. I met the wizard Asita and received the way of the wizard from him. You, Dirtaka, met a disciple of the Buddha Dharma who possessed the 10 powers of the Buddhas and learned to practice Zen in an ancient time. We were friends, and I took the wizard way and you took the Zen way. After that, our karmic paths separated, and 6 eons have passed since we went our own ways. 6 kalpas. It's a long time to remember that, that old friendship from a past life, a past stream of karmic consciousness. Following its stream of cause and effect along through these 6 eons, we've now met again. Venerable Dhirtaka said, "So many eons apart is true, but they were not in vain. Now you must abandon the false and return to the true, and thus enter the Buddha vehicle." Return to the true. This is like Rachel's Dharma name, Kigen. So this character Ki means return, also means refuge. So you must abandon the false and take refuge in the true and enter the Buddha vehicle. And Michaka said, "In former times, the wizard Asita made a prediction saying, after 6 eons, you will meet a fellow student and realize the fruit of purity or awakening. Isn't meeting you my destiny? I ask you, Osho, to be compassionate and kind now and liberate me." The Venerable Dhirtaka gave him the complete monastic precepts and let him leave home as a monk. The other wizards felt proud of themselves at first. And I guess that means, like, because, like, he'd have to do that Buddhist thing, but, like, you know, we're doing the true wizard thing. They were proud of themselves. At first, but then Venerable Dhirtaka exerted great supernatural powers as a left home follower of the Buddha, and as a result, all the wizards aroused bodhicitta, Hotsubodaishin, and simultaneously left home. The 8,000 wizards all became monks. It was right at the time when they decided to become monks and follow him that Dhirtaka said, "Practicing wizardry and studying the trivial is like being dragged around with a rope. You yourself should know that if you leave the small stream and immediately come to the great ocean, you will realize the unborn." And Michaka realized awakening. Then the Tower of Wizards became a Zen temple, and all the wizards cast aside their magic wands and practiced the way, the inconceivable way, beyond all sorcery, wizardry, and special powers. Keizan says, "Even if you study wizardry and learn to prolong your life or command the marvelous use of supernatural powers, you can only really perceive 80,000 eons into the past and 80,000 eons into the future. but you cannot scrutinize anything before or after that. Okay, so our great founding ancestor.
All being that happened beyond 8 eons ago, you forget that.
Yeah, 80,000.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He was 6, wasn't he, or something?
Hmm?
Weren't their friendship six
eons, yeah. They were friends for 6 eons. But now Kazon, the Japanese commentator now, is saying, if you practice wizardry, you will be able to actually perceive 80,000 eons into the past or the future, but that's as far as you can go with wizardry.
Well, I see if you do the Buddhist more.
That's kind of implied.
Nice.
Yeah.
You get that.
Yep.
In this case, there's only 6, not 8,000, right?
Yeah. Maybe they could have done that too, but they had only met 6 eons ago. So this is like, the Buddha way is like beyond.
72,000 spare.
Yeah. We might ask why we might want to perceive 80,000 eons into the past or future, but it might be useful in various ways. It might not be, but I think what's being implied here is it's not nearly as useful as dropping off body and mind and being free and untrammeled. Even if you cultivate the meditative trances, the jhanas, at the stage of neither perception nor non-perception and enter the trances of no mind or thought, you will unfortunately be born in the celestial realm of no perception and become a celestial being, a deva with long life. Unfortunately. So this is kind of classic Buddhism, Kazon saying here, that these jhanas that the Buddha practiced and recommended, in and of themselves, just lead to this birth in these heavenly realms for long, long time, even eons, but not the simple, direct opportunity of just dropping off body and mind, realizing the unborn here and now, right in the midst of this ordinary life. But Buddhism still teaches all this stuff as possibilities. So Kazen's saying it's kind of too bad if you just do this path of jhana, deepening your jhana practices without the insight into the unborn. Even though you get rid of a corporeal body, you still will have the functioning of karmic consciousness. Thus, you will not be able to meet a Buddha or comprehend the way. And when the results of karmic consciousness are exhausted, you will fall into avicii hell. Do you know avicii hell? It means, avicii means unceasing. This is all part of Buddhist cosmology too, right? All these levels of hell realms, and the lowest one at the bottom is the unceasing, unremitting, torturous hell realm.
No getting out.
Well, there is eventually getting out, but it lasts longer, and there's no break from suffering. It's incessant suffering.
You can get it and get out.
Yeah, luckily that's the good news of the Buddha Dharma, is that none of these realms are permanent, unlike various religions where heaven and hell really are permanent. Buddhism also has heavens and hells that arise due to karma, our own actions. But everything's flexible, everything's possible. Where we ourselves might have actually been in hell realms in this life, or we might have been in heaven realms in this life, but none of them lasted, did they?
And the question that arises, if you went to, let's say, the first jhana, what would stop you, just the same as if you were in a human form, from then at some point just gaining enlightenment and then skipping out into skipping the rest of
them? Yeah, you could, from the first jhana, or from any of the jhanas, you could, yeah. And in fact, Keizan's going to bring up that very point later in this chapter too. But, and in fact, that's what the Buddha in the Pali Suttas, that's kind of what the Buddha's recommending, is that you do practice these deeply concentrated meditation states, and from that basis, from that ground, then you direct the mind towards insight, towards, you start inquiring from that ground. But you maybe have heard this, right, that the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, there were other teachers in India teaching these jhanas already. That wasn't the Buddha's invention. And the Buddha mastered them, but they were all impermanent. And it wasn't the realization of the unborn. Yes?
Yeah, so the jhana word you're saying, is this the J-N-A-N-A word, or the D-H-Y-A-N-A?
Yes. One of them is Pali language, and one of them is Sanskrit language. Same word. And, interestingly and controversially, the Chinese way of saying it, that same word is Chan, and the Japanese way of saying it is Zen. So, I say controversial because, though the word Zen is a translation of this word jhana, these meditative absorption states that are very specifically defined in Buddhism, we understand Zen as not to really be about those states. Even though it's kind of like a misnomer, or it's a, and even the old Zen records tell that story, right? It's even in here, in the transmission of light, I think in the Bodhidharma section, where they say, in old times, Bodhidharma came from India, and they knew there's this jhana thing in India, and Bodhidharma just was meditating constantly in this cave, right? So they said he's a jhana practitioner. He must be practicing the jhanas. And then it kind of stuck. And then when Bodhidharma actually met people and talked to them, which is a little bit rare, then he made it clear that it was not actually about these specific jhana states, but it was about bring me your mind and I'll free it for you. But when I look for it, I can't find it. Well, then I freed it for you. That's not the jhanas, but that's Zen. Yeah. Yes.
So what I heard was not to put too much importance on the jhanas, but that it's kind of a natural process. In practice itself, in zazen, that occurs. Yeah, it's not big. It's not nothing special. It's just these things you go through, you would go naturally anyway. It's not so important what level you are and all that other stuff. That's, I think, the emphasis.
That's the emphasis in Zen, yeah. The emphasis in Zen is that jhanas are nothing special. I think that's right. That's right. And they may arise naturally in zazen, especially like sesshin kind of zazen, or may not. And you know, when you read them, the descriptions of them, I would say there's like 8 total, right? And I think the lower jhanas maybe naturally arise. I think these so-called higher jhanas maybe don't naturally arise, but they could. I think they could. But they're pretty absorbed states where, like, you know, some, like, the Buddha talks about, like, he was in this, like, in one of the deeper jhanas, and there was this thunderstorm around him, and it washed out all the trees and houses, and a bunch of people died, and then after the thunderstorm, he got up, and they're like, "But Buddha, how did you survive this?" And he's like, "Survive what? There was a thunderstorm?" So that kind of depth of jhana is like, maybe doesn't naturally arise in sesshin. And I think it's not actually the point, because from a certain perspective, these jhanas have a kind of duality to them. In one sense, they're completely removed from our ordinary experience, so that's kind of dualistic, and you can't actually function in the jhana. You can't move, for example, in a jhana. You can't like carry the jhana into your activities by their very definition. They're just formal meditation states. But Zen is all about non-duality between your meditation and the rest of your life, right? And you do carry your non-dual awareness into all your activities too. So the beauty of Zen, we might say, and isn't it nice? It sounds so much simpler than going through these eight jhanas. And maybe it is. Maybe it depends on the person. But sometimes in Zen, they would say, actually, it's much more profound than the jhanas, and it's not really like necessarily easier. It's not really in the realm, and can't really be discussed in the realm of easy or difficult, actually, right? It's beyond these categories. The unborn. And although students, this is Kazan, our author here, commenting. Although students of the small vehicle, the so-called Hina Yana, but here we could take it as compared to the vast vehicle, but the small vehicle of personal liberation that's not emphasizing the complete freedom and ease of all beings, the all-inclusiveness of the great vehicle. You could say that's partly why it's called great. It's all-inclusive. But students of the small vehicle attain the first, second, third, and fourth fruits, or jhanas. Oh no, actually, in this case, these four fruits are also this classic Buddhist teaching, right? Stream enter, once returner, non-returner, arhat. Right? They're like, and these are fruits not just of jhana, but of insight. Particularly insight into no separate self. And so small vehicle practitioners attain these four fruits, and they attain the rank of Pratyeka Buddha, which is again, even in modern Theravada Buddhism, Pratyeka Buddhas are like these amazingly honored beings. They're like, it is almost like the goal, but in the Mahayana they get a bad rap. Pratyeka Buddhas, Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas are like these self-enlightened ones, and they're not devoted to the liberation of all beings. Necessarily, anyway.
Compare that to the comment you made yesterday, that the only job the teacher has is to be happy.
Yeah, so from a small vehicle perspective, that it would be an interesting twist on it, that the Mahayana is not that different if we look at it that way, that the job of all of us is to really find happiness or liberation and understand the principle, like not to find a conditioned happiness, right, but to find an unconditioned happiness that doesn't rely on the circumstances. And then that is a great benefit to others, especially if we're hang around others. If we sometimes I've seen Pratyeka Buddha be translated as hermit Buddhas, loosely translated, and maybe because they're like solitary, they're just like, now I'm free, but like, this world is such a mess, like, that's not, you know, no need to hang around others who are suffering. But if the Pratyeka Buddhas were willing to hang around them, then that would be a great benefit. Then they would almost be like bodhisattvas. The bodhisattva's vow is to hang around others and be happy. Yeah. Yeah. Find a way to peace and a reliable way, so that it's not just like randomly pops up sometimes, and not always. More like when we're not at peace, we know the way to find our way back to peace.
That's the ground.
But those who reach this rank of Pratika Buddha, but don't have the vow to hang around others, still this is practice in terms of body and mind, or making an effort in the way in terms of delusion and enlightenment. So it's like, even in these great realizations, Keizan's pointing out some duality. So making a distinction between, now I'm enlightened, and before I wasn't, and it still deals with a body and a mind. For this reason, saintly ones with the first fruit pass through 80,000 eons and then become bodhisattvas who first arouse the thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta, to benefit all beings for the first time. So this is the part I was thinking when Richard said, someone on this arhat path of these four fruits along the way be from this absorption state, couldn't then they realize awakening and even like a Mahayana awakening? He's saying here, yes, they could. And I don't know where Keizan got this, but he's saying those at the first fruit of stream enter means like they've gotten into it, this small vehicle realization, but they haven't kind of gone all the way with it. So it's going to take them longer to become a bodhisattva. It's going to take them 80,000 eons till their first moment of bodhicitta, which is the compassionate wish, right? Bodhicitta is, we spent a whole year, right, talking about bodhicitta, of this aspiration to be happy, but for the benefit of all beings, to be completely awakened in order to help all beings find the awakening. So it's an inherently compassionate aspiration, and that defines the Mahayana. So the saintly ones in the first fruit pass through 80,000 eons, then become bodhisattvas and first arouse bodhicitta. Those in the second fruit, once returner, pass through 60,000 eons, it's a little bit less, and then they become bodhisattvas, arousing the aspiration of bodhicitta for the first time. Those with the third fruit of non-returner pass through only 40,000 eons, and then they first arouse bodhicitta. The Pratyeka Buddhas, who are even further along, the Pratyeka Buddhas pass through only 10,000 eons, and then they enter the path of the bodhisattva. Flies right by. Even though one comes to the bodhisattva path as a result of good conditions in the past, unfortunately, as a result of this, the turning of the wheel of karma does not end. This is also like being dragged with a rope. One is not truly liberated. So, all of these small vehicle practices and realizations are still involving being bound by karma and conditions, like being dragged with a rope, according to Keizan and the Zen Mahayana vastness. Keizan says, even if you destroy the 88 kleshas, or defilements of views and concepts, the subtle defilements, the upakleshas, like pride and of one's own attainment, and countless delusions, so that not an atom of them remains, this is still just conditioned karmic effort, and finally not the undefiled result of Buddhahood. Such efforts in the way as returning to the root, going back to the source, waiting for enlightenment, and making these your standard, are all in this category.
It's so striking to me, you know, in the years where I was involved with Sufism, Pirbalat, and he would say that it's so parallel. He would say that there's all this past and jhanas, and when we meditate and talk about where he was.
Levels. All these traditions have levels.
Except Zen. He would reach full awakeness. But that was the penultimate. And the ultimate was the return. So it's not really, he's saying the same thing that you're saying, that enlightenment is not the end. The end is bringing it back to the world. That's the last and final step. So in a way, in Sufism too, they say, at least in that Sufi order, that ultimately your full cycle ends with you returning to be with others.
Yeah, that's one way we could put it, is the importance of, like in these ox herding pictures, right? There's at the end, it's returning to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. But another way we could also see it from a Zen perspective is that there's all these stages and paths of practice, but then the Zen awakening is not so much the end of them, but it pervades all of them. It's all pervading from the beginning, and it also pervades delusion. Before one even starts on these stages, the Zen awakening pervades all our experience. That's true non-duality. Because we see that all these stages are themselves actually unborn, and there is only the unborn, unceasing, ever-present, ordinary awareness right now. And if we enter the first jhana, that unborn awareness is exactly the same as it is right now. And if we enter the eighth jhana, the unborn awareness is just aware of the eighth jhana. And if we realize the fruit of pratyeka Buddhahood, the unborn awareness is just now aware of the realization of pratyeka Buddhahood. And it never changes as these stages of realization unfold. So radical a notion. And it's exactly the same in totally deluded ordinary beings, completely caught up in greed, hate, and delusion. And it's exactly the same in pratyeka Buddhas, Shravakas, and Bodhisattvas, and Buddhas, even. The unborn, unchanging, ever-present awareness just receives all of these experiences, while it itself is not an experience.
But at what point? Because there's the normal development of an animal, in this case, let's say a human being, from birth through childhood, through the different phases, as they become, gain speech, and then they gain, you know, they go through various, supposed, you know, sort of typical stages. Are we saying that at some point of maturity, then this kind of a shift in awareness could happen, or are we saying an infant could have it?
Actually, we're saying an infant does have it, always.
What can he do with it?
You could say then there's the issue of the recognition of it and appreciation of it, and that could happen to an infant or anyone along the way. And to remember this is, I think, so important, because here we are. We have all day as the potential to appreciate this unborn awareness. Yes?
I like the image of the ocean being the unborn awareness.
Yeah.
Because today the ocean is coming to us, literally raining, and we are 70% ocean ourselves without knowing it or remembering it. So that is a sort of a simile for that kind of unborn awareness being always out there just waiting for us to manifest it through our actions and being.
Yeah.
Always in us, around us, through us, and everywhere, as you're saying.
Yeah, and the small streams.
We kind of remember thinking of the ocean out there, coming down now, and in us.
Yep.
That we're permeated by it.
The ocean Yeah, the ocean you speak of is not like the Pacific Ocean that has the border of beaches, right? Because it's also in the air and also within us. So that ocean has no boundaries.
Right? It permeates everywhere.
And that is like the unborn, yeah. It permeates everywhere. We might say the metaphor still breaks down because maybe like the ocean doesn't penetrate into the center of a rock mountain. But this is, yeah, this is the ocean without any boundaries, edges, or center. And all the small streams return to the ocean. The small streams of the small vehicle path are actually made of the ocean. Yes, Patrick.
Kiyosawa's description of 84,000 kalpas of understanding. But, you know, our practice really does ask us to, really does ask us to think about, you know, boundlessness and abide in boundlessness. Advice to try not to say experience all the time about this, just abide in the boundlessness that we are. And the Lotus Sutra sort of does the same thing, but just as Baroque images as it displays, you know, what it does is really kind of, you know, get us out of this, you know, these boundaries, or even these boundaries, maybe that's what Tension was talking about. You know, burn down San Francisco Zen Center just so that we can, you know, think outside the box.
Yeah. And there is no box.
I appreciate sort of always being, you know, brought there.
Yeah.
And meeting, you know, with all the sutras, you know, initially, Dharmas are flying in, and you've got these distant Buddhas, you know, waving at us from the hillside.
Totally.
I appreciate it. This is where we're going to start in this, this kind of huge, boundless space, because, you know, that's really our true face.
Yeah, it's physically boundless, and it's unbound by time too. So it's spaceless and it's timeless. So that is a nice point about the 80,000 eons is still in the realm of time. And it's not so much that we think, well, then we have to go further. Zen goes further than 80,000 eons. It's more like, no, Zen goes here. That is further than 80,000 eons, right? The timeless. There's no time. And and really, this is the, again, the unborn mind of awareness. When we're in touch with that, we see that it is actually timeless. And in fact, the very name unborn implies not only is it not something, but it did not begin. There's no starting point. And unceasing, undying, the deathless, means it does not end either. It's outside of the conception of time, which is truly a conceptual construct of sentient beings. Time and space are the maybe we could even say the most fundamental constructs of which all the other ones emerge from. And we say often, I myself, I'm not so willing to go there. I'll say, well, I'll give up my, you know, view about the small vehicle or something in these kind of constructs, but am I willing to give up my view of time and space? Sometimes I might say, you know, we need a little bit of ground here, don't we? But in fact, I think we're being encouraged to, in Zazen, can we actually open to the very ordinary awareness that is already actually free from time and space. Right now. You know, that defiles it a little bit to say, Sharon Zander say it, to say only this. Oh, that like locks it into like this. Or just right now. Oh, that like, that brings it into a specific time called now. It's not really here or now, but that's the closest we can get in the conceptual realm, say right here and right now. But actually, the unborn is actually not here in any location, and it's not now in any sense of time. So we can sit in this. We dedicate the merit of our practice to the complete awakening to the unborn. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.